Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview with actor Jason Bradley. I interviewed Jason first several years ago when he was here as part of the Oslo Repertory Theatre Company, performing in La Bette and Boeing Boeing. In that interview, he talks a great deal about his performance in Boeing and Boeing and his approach to acting. I'm replaying a significant portion of that because what Jason says about acting and his particular approach to acting is so interesting. But then I interviewed him again very recently as he is here in support of the brand new Urbanite Theater, which is having its grand opening, and he is performing in the very first show of the season. Jason is interesting, compelling, thoughtful, as well as talented. So hang on, here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice, oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive.
The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about finding comfort, not from without, but from within. The comfort of being who you really are. When you have that comfort, then you are almost never uncomfortable in the world. But it's my experience as a psychotherapist that most of us are not comfortable in ourselves. Most of us learned at some point in our life that what we were was not okay, and so we began to be at odds with it. Of course, that's a lot of what I find in my private practice. People trying to be something they're not, mad at themselves for something they think they should be, some way that they should be, something that they should be doing or not doing. I play interviews with people who make their living or their life with an art, because in our culture, that's
pretty much has to be who you are, because it's very difficult. Even when you're somebody who's working, it's a very difficult career. We don't make it easy for artists in this culture. And you'll hear Jason, my interview today is with Jason Bradley, you'll hear him talking about how lucky he was to have the kind of early support from his parents, from the place that he lived, from the people, his friends who surrounded him, from the teachers, from the school that he went to. This encouragement to be who you are, to find yourself, and as Jason talks about acting, as a place where he is at home. And that the idea that one can be at home, that one can find what works for oneself, what is oneself. That's the whole point of this show.
And as I said, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, because when you listen to them, you can hear what it sounds like. A minute ago, I was talking about how difficult it is to make a living as an artist in our culture, or never mind make a living, give yourself to it in any way. Take time out of your life. Make it part of your life. It's very difficult. But when you listen to people who have done it, are doing it, then you hear what it sounds like to be what we therapists call congruent. It's another way of saying that what you hear is what there is, you know, what you get. And this is true for pretty much everybody that I interview. And it is glaringly true for Jason Bradley. When you listen to Jason, what you hear is his complete at-easeness. Jason is not pretending to be someone. He isn't thinking, what should I say now, or how should I present myself? He is simply Jason. And my intent with this show is to say that that is possible for all of us. And it is my hope that when you listen to someone like Jason, you are inspired to ask yourself, is this true for me? And if not, to ask yourself whether you'd like it to be true for you and wonder how to make that true for you. As I said in the run-up, in the first part of this interview, Jason and I will be talking a lot about his performance in Boeing Boeing, which he did several years ago. I'm going to play, right before I play my interview with Jason, I'm going to play a little piece of Sharon Leslie's review of Boeing Boeing. This is the part of her review where she talks about Jason's performance. And after Sharon talks about Jason, I'm going to let Jason speak for himself. So now here is Sharon Leslie talking about Jason Bradley in Boeing Boeing, followed by my interview with Jason.
Best of all was Jason Bradley as the Whirlwind Robert. How he contorts his body and plays the physical humor while maintaining an air of innocence is magic to watch. He doesn't just steal the show, he wins it by establishing the pace and energy necessary for a good farce to play well.
I'm here with Jason Bradley. I interview people who make their living or their life with an art.
Uh-huh.
And you clearly do that.
I do.
And I always ask the same question, and it is, how did it happen? How did it get started? When did you know? How did it find you?
Well, it's interesting that you ask every artist that, because it's always subjective.
Yes, you know? Of course.
It always winds and weaves and surprises you. And
well, yes, it quite often surprises people.
Yeah.
Did it surprise you, or were you?
I was raised in Wisconsin, and I lived in a small town, and we lived outside of that small town, and I had a huge backyard, and beyond the backyard, a huge sort of forest, and I know in the summer times I was just sort of given free rein to
run and play
to do it. Yeah.
Okay. And, so no exposure to nothing.
I didn't see a professional production until I was in high school.
Television?
Of a play. Oh, television.
Movies?
Television and movies, yeah.
But
yeah,
no, I want to do that, that's for me. None of that.
No.
Wow.
No. You know, a great tool for an actor is imagination.
So are you saying that because you were given free rein to imagine, to create in your head what was going on, that
served you as an actor,
yeah.
Or that set you up?
It set me up, and I never really let it go. You know, I always sought it out. And I think there's a sense that, you know, every child plays, but not everybody becomes an adult and, you know, settles into a certain way of going through the day, you know. I just kind of continue to live with my imagination, I think, through high school. And when I found plays in high school, I realized that I fit in there, you know.
Yeah.
There was very much an uncomfortability, you know, going into high school. I didn't really know where I fit. I wasn't a jock.
Okay, so now I'm really interested in this thing about the imagination.
Yeah.
And so does that mean that you daydreamed a lot? Does that mean that you...
Neighborhood friends, you know, running through the forest. You start
pretending.
You start creating sets of rules, you know, which relates very much to any play, you know.
Alternative lives?
Yeah, you get the script and those are your rules. And you can play.
So you started doing this very young.
Yeah.
Like creating alternative stories,
sure,
lives,
yeah,
that stuff, right?
Sure, yeah.
And you had other friends who did it with you?
Yeah, kings and queens and knights and sword fights and who knows what, you know.
Right.
And, you know, our playground was, you know, rural Wisconsin, and, you know, the sky was the limit. I didn't have cable. We had three television channels, and they came in spotty because we were in the country, so it was outside, even in the wintertime, you know.
Okay, so now, did any of your friends become actors?
All of my high school friends, closely knit high school friends, are still related to theater in some way.
That is amazing.
We had a really good... arts program and a really great acting teacher in high school that I'll never forget.
Wait a minute, an acting teacher in high school in Wisconsin?
We had acting 1, acting 2, acting 3.
You're kidding. We could take
stagecraft 1 and 2, and then we could do independent...
In a public high school?
In a public high school, yeah. And it doesn't exist anymore in that high school.
I don't think it existed anywhere else.
No. When we had it, we had an improv team, and we would we would perform on Fridays... this little 250-seat theater.
Well, that is remarkable.
If we'd fill it up and it'd make you feel so good about yourself, you know. I mean, it really was nurtured, and it's the reason why so many of my friends in high school still are involved in theater in some way.
Okay, so when did you notice this and think, this fits me, I fit this?
I started freshman year, and I didn't miss a play until I graduated. By the time we graduated, the students were, you know, producing their own plays and, you know, renting sort of space in the high school to put on their stuff. And, but I think it was junior year that I decided, you know, when everybody starts thinking about college and that sort of thing. Junior year, there wasn't much else that was really gripping me the way theater was and acting was. And, I had seen a couple productions at the Guthrie Theater. I started to understand that this was a viable way to not only make a living, but to, you know, to fulfill myself and really live
a
full
life.
Yeah.
Right.
So that's been the goal ever since, and I've never looked back.
So, no, clearly. But what did you say to your parents?
I said I want to be an actor probably... my junior year. We did Romeo and Juliet, and I played Mercutio.
Oh, my.
Got my first lesson in rejection because I wanted to play Romeo really bad. My girlfriend at the time was Juliet, best friend was Romeo. But I loved Mercutio, and it was a blessing in disguise, you know, a surprise and a blessing in disguise. Because I remember so specifically wanting to do it from then on, like really falling in love with Shakespeare. With text, you know, and I remember myself freshman year not even wanting to read Romeo and Juliet. Like, it just didn't interest me.
Your freshman year in high school?
Yeah.
But by the time
I was a junior, I was in it.
What happened? Do you know?
I think, you know, you have a certain amount of prejudice when you're a high schooler, what's cool and what's not cool.
Mm-hmm.
And Shakespeare, when I was a freshman, wasn't cool. And I didn't have any time for it or any reason for it. But then when I began to realize that I saw Midsummer Night's Dream at the Guthrie Theater, and I saw As You Like It at the Guthrie Theater, freshman and sophomore year, and I began to see how text was related to the sense of play and imagination, and I had already gotten that first taste of what fulfills you when you're on stage.
Mm-hmm.
and it all just started to come together. You know, doors were opening left and right. You
okay,
know? And,
go back to text is related to play.
Yeah, well, Shakespeare, when you read it and you're not exposed to theater, you're not particularly fond for theater, Shakespeare is a difficult thing, you know. Yeah. It's a very difficult, sort of daunting, intimidating, and ultimately it's easy to write off, you know.
Yeah.
But when you key into it from a performance,
you see what it looks like on stage.
You see what it looks like on stage. You know,
it,
you
it
already
comes
know.
Alive.
Yeah, and you already know what it feels like to be on stage, and then you think,
Oh
my gosh, I want to say all this beautiful poetry. I want to understand it, and then I want to get up there, and then I want to say it, and then
that's making me cry.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah.
No, and then I did it my junior year as Mercutio, and we were supposed to read Pride and Prejudice. I didn't. We were supposed to read Romeo and Juliet. I didn't. You know, I had to go back and apologize to my English teacher from my freshman year.
Did you?
Yeah, you know. Because I really made my living, you know, doing...
The things you wouldn't read.
That I wouldn't, you know, that to a sort of strong-willed, you know, teenager.
Are you an only child?
No, I have three younger sisters.
Oh, younger sisters. You're the oldest boy?
I'm the big brother.
There
yeah.
we go, yeah.
No, I'm the big brother, yeah.
Right.
So... Wasn't much much room for...
No. So, did any of your sisters?
No, none of them are artists. They all live in Wisconsin still. Two of them are married. One of them is very young still. She's in middle school still. So, yeah.
But so they're living in more conventional country.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, definitely.
So
definitely.
You're the the rebel. The,
I don't know what happened. I don't
well, you know what happened.
Yeah.
But so what did they say when you said, listen, I'm going to be an actor? I mean, because they must have had no frame of reference for it.
They didn't have a lot of frame of reference for it, no. I mean, not to the extent that, you know, that I live my life now. I mean, they understand it much more now. They were really, I've got a really supportive family. I mean, they... They told me I can basically do whatever I want to do, you know. And they never, there was never an addendum to that, you know. Even that, like, well, you can follow your passion for a while, you know what I mean?
Yes.
You know,
yes.
I've talked to people, I've talked to people who said, you know, I always wanted to be an actress, but my mom wouldn't let me or my dad wouldn't let me.
Right.
I've even had somebody say, you know, my daughter wanted to be an actress, but I said, oh, no, you're going to go get a job.
Wow.
No, you're going to school.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, to my face, they don't understand the...
No.
The implied sort of insult.
It's not implied. It's straight out.
Yeah, you know.
And even worse, it seems to me, than the insult to you is the... This is something of a hobby horse for me, so it's very meaningful.
Yeah.
It's the... The implication that they know better than that child,
yeah,
and that they have the right to tell that child who it is,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And that's not going to go well.
Yeah, yeah.
That's gonna be bad for everybody eventually.
I think so.
Right.
But my parents have been great. I mean, there's obviously been a lot of hardship. This isn't...
No, and I want to talk a little bit about that. So you're a junior, you're a senior, you've fallen in love, you know, this is it. You know, it's clear to you. What do you do?
I did a lot of research about where to go to school, and I went to a unified audition in Chicago. First time I'd ever been in Chicago. I lived 5 hours away my entire life, never driven to Chicago. But I'll never forget that first week of February going down to Chicago. I'd set up auditions with all these conservatories because I didn't really want to go to... I wanted to go to a conservatory. I knew what I wanted to do. I didn't want to go to a college where I had to do all the math and all
Right. No, you just wanted this thing.
Yeah, I wanted this thing. I wanted to go to a liberal arts conservatory, you know. So I applied to NYU and California Institute of the Arts and Juilliard and DePaul and all of these schools, and I remember getting, when I was there, I did a walk-in audition for Northern Illinois University, and I had never thought about them, they weren't on my map at all, but they offered me a scholarship based on my audition, And I got into all the other schools, and I was so happy. You know, I had these little congratulations
letters,
which was great.
You know?
But it was expensive, you know. It was really expensive. And I didn't know if I wanted to do film or television or anything like that, right. The more lucrative part of it. I just knew that I loved being on stage, you know.
Yeah.
And I couldn't say no to this scholarship. And I really felt a connection with the faculty at NIU.
And they clearly felt one with you.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they wouldn't have, right?
Yeah. So I'm not $100,000 in the in the bucket,
right.
Which was good. And they were close to Chicago. I loved my training there. I went to Ireland after my undergrad and studied there for a little while. And I came back here and started working.
Do you remember what you used to audition for them?
Mercutio. I did the Queen Mab speech for Mercutio. And I think I probably did one of those really overused contemporary monologues from one of those books, those stay away from these monologues books,
right.
Which actually is titled, 50 monologues.
Right.
You know, I'm sure I did one of those, but the Mercutio thing stood out for me. I thought this is a way that I can show, my physicality, because I'm a very physical actor. And I think that's it showed a command of text and that sort of thing, and I think that's what the auditors responded to.
It's interesting because it's Robert, isn't it?
In
Boing Boing.
Yeah.
He's so not Shakespeare. Shakespeare. And, it's funny, and it's interesting to hear you talk about that, and then I would have imagined you to have a different, I mean, I know you're an actor, and so you're very facile, and you can do anything, but it's still, this is the other end of the continuum.
It sure is.
Right.
It sure is.
Yeah. Do you want to talk a little bit about it? I mean, I want to say, when you said that thing about physicality, my reviewer talks about that, about what you do with your body.
Yeah.
In it. Was that directed, or is that you?
Well, Greg was a great director. I really like working with Greg. To start off with, we would do little moments over and over and over again until we sort of got the meaning of it. And then when we got on our feet, it was the same thing, sort of repetitive parts of very small parts of the play. And
Me and Brian, Mercedes, or
any of the flight attendants,
right.
Kate, Angela, Kim, and... We go over and over and over again. I don't think we ran like a full scene for a long time. And
do you think that he was picking moments that he thought were pivotal, difficult, important in some way, or simply?
No, it was just from sort of like beginning to end, and we're trying to figure out what it looks like on stage, and he's trying to figure it out. We're all trying to figure it out, and the creative energy is kind of.
Yes.
All over the room, and I think in the process of developing a language with Greg, because this is the first time I've worked with him, I just started to feel a lot of freedom to say, "What about this?"
Mm-hmm.
What about this?
Wouldn't he do this?
Yeah, or let's give this a try. Let's see if we can make this work. I remember specifically this one part where I go around the couch like three times, putting a cape on the Italian air hostess.
That's right.
And then as I grab her bag and go around, she's taking the cape
off.
And sat it on the couch and I put the bag on her.
Mm-hmm.
And, we worked that almost like a composer, finding the right note for the next piece of music. You know what I mean? You know?
Yeah.
And then you go back.
It's funny because I thought you were going to say like a choreographer.
It is choreography, yeah,
right,
yeah.
Right.
It's very
right.
much like that too. It's dance choreography, and
right.
it's also music too. I hear the music too,
Are you a musician? Do you sing? Do you play?
No, I don't sing. I don't sing, and I haven't danced in a long time.
But you have done.
But you have to have those. You have to have your foot in.
Yeah. You have to be able to move, which you clearly can.
Yeah. You have to be there. So. I'm trying to remember. There was an interview with Bradley Whitford, who played Bernard on Broadway.
Really?
Uh-huh.
And Bradley Whitford, really?
From West Wing.
I know who he is. I'm just having trouble picturing it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an interesting choice.
Yeah.
Right?
So because
he's so, I don't know, dour.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
I think so.
Yeah.
But he's also got a lot. He's got a great comedic timing. I understand in terms of his comedy.
I believe you. I would love to have seen it.
Yeah. But he said Boeing Bowling was a Japanese tea ceremony with tits. That was how specific it needs to be.
Yeah, right.
You can say it was a Japanese tea ceremony with short skirts. If you want.
Thank you. I'll leave the whole thing in. Probably.
And the Japanese tea
because
ceremony,
because it's so stylized,
it's so specific. You know, it has to be, if the door doesn't open at the right time and that one closes at the right time,
the whole thing is gone. Right, exactly.
You know, if I don't get in front of the door right before she gets to the door, it's all gone.
Right.
You know, the comedy is all
gone.
And
what's really just occurred to me, which of course, I mean, you certainly know, is that you have to do that even while the energy level inside of you must be amazing.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, then in a way you have to be hugely energetic and controlled.
Yes.
Right. It's a very difficult, I mean, that hadn't occurred to me before.
Yes.
But do you know what I mean?
Yes, I absolutely know what you mean. And that would be the struggle. You know, farces are no fun to rehearse. They're no fun to rehearse until you can actually run it.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Right.
You know, until then it's a headache.
Yeah, and then?
And then it's exhilarating.
Yeah,
yes.
Right.
But there are always like three balls in the air. You know, you talk about that tension and that physical excitement.
Right.
That has to be there, but there has to be a part of your brain that's actually calm.
Two, three, four.
Calm and listening to the other actor, because if you're not talking and listening, it is just choreography.
Right,
and all of a sudden the humor goes away.
Right. And in addition, when I said that two, three, four, you have to be knowing where you need to be next and how long you have to get there and all that at the same time that you're listening and at the same time you're in this frenzy.
Yeah.
Because you're in a frenzy a lot of the time in that play.
Yes, you do. But there has to be a relaxed Jason in there somewhere that's listening to the audience, you know, that's processing their laugh, you know.
Did they get it?
If the laugh hits harder one day, then you have to go two, three, four. Two, three, four, it'll go on, you know what I mean? So you're still conducting in your head in a way, you know. I remember running it right before we did tech. And we were so happy that all the technical elements were in place. And we did the play, and nothing went wrong, but it wasn't funny.
But it didn't feel right,
It wasn't funny. And Greg was like, that's weird how it wasn't funny. Everything was right. Everybody got everything right, but it just wasn't.
And
because everybody was so focused on
getting it right.
We hadn't relaxed into it. You know, we hadn't been able to trust it yet.
Right.
And then
you were so busy doing your thing.
Yeah.
Right.
And, you know, of course, that ball dropped, and then we had to pick that up and try to do it again the next day.
This is a play where you have to be paying attention to your thing almost every minute.
Yes.
You know, I mean, because as you say, if you're in the wrong place for a moment, the play can fall apart.
Yes. And I get a 5-minute break, and then I'm on. There's one little 5-minute break I get when I step out right before the German comes.
Oh, yeah, when you go into your room.
Yep.
Right.
Yep. And then I'm back on. So we're off to the races.
Yes, and you're on. You're just on.
Yeah. But it's exhilarating. I find myself playing the non-traditional lead. But there's an I don't quite fit. And it works. It always works for me trying to interpret those characters, I think. You know, when Greg said, Jason Bradley, I don't think that either of us at that point, even when I read the play the first time, I didn't think it was going to be what it was. I was terribly intimidated by this role. I was. But you know, like I said, this sort of play comes together piece by piece, moment by moment, dance move by dance move, you know, musical note by musical note, you know. You get done composing the whole thing, and then you go back and you realize that, you know, 3/5 of it doesn't work. And you have to, or you were too frantic up here and you ran out of steam down here,
know.
So, but that was one of the joys working with Greg and trying to figure this out, is really, I think both of us were really surprised by just how many stops we could pull out, you know, and see what landed.
And I thought you were going to say something else.
Why?
How really right you were for it.
Oh, I don't know that I would ever say that.
Oh, but good, and I'll say it. I'll say it, and it's so interesting. Because, you know, all the other stuff that you've talked about doing, is, I mean, Mercutio and Darcy and, you know, Horvath, I mean, they're just not, I wouldn't have seen it.
No, they're
you
not.
Know? No,
they're
it's
not.
Wonderful, isn't it?
It
I mean,
is.
It's another quiver in your bow. No. Bow, what is that? Arrow in your quiver?
Arrow in your quiver, there you go. I like that.
Right.
I like that. No, I don't want to do farce again for a couple of years.
So, we made a leap here, I think.
Yeah, we did a little
didn't
bit.
Didn't we? Yeah, so how did we get from Northern Illinois to, or Ireland even?
Yeah.
To, I mean, there are a few years between then and now, no?
Yeah, I went back to Chicago after Ireland and after graduating. And, you know, there's always a couple of dark years between, mm-hmm. between getting done with your training and moving into a career.
Right.
And, I think it was a year and a half for me between getting my first... I did one non-union show in Chicago, and it kind of showcased me really well, and I got nominated for a Jeff Award for it, which is the Chicago sort of stage awards. But it somehow put me on the map, and I started to get auditions for stuff that I
you
wasn't even
before.
Really seen for otherwise, yeah. And then I went into audition for Arcadia, and I got Septimus. And that was my first union job.
Oh, my God, what a way to start.
Yeah, and I remember auditioning for Peter. I auditioned for him, I think they had me back 3 times, because I didn't have a resume, you know.
Yes, let's see if he can really do it more than, let's see.
And, you know, I found out later that, you know, the artistic director and he, to a certain extent, maybe thought that I was just, like, a good mimic, you know? Like, I could get the... Like, I was good with dialect. You take a risk when you hire somebody who's non-union that has no references, you know?
Yeah.
And they had me back for very good reason. But, you know, having a good relationship with text and having the British dialect down really well, I've got a good ear for dialects, and I was somehow able to convince him to take a risk on me. And that relationship with Indiana Rep and with him is something that's still going.
You must have been terrified.
I was. I was terrified. But I was ready. You know what I mean? I was, you know, I had done the day job thing, and I had done rehearsing at night after the day job for no money. And it starts to eat away at you, you know what I mean? You know, you hate to say that you need affirmation, but in a way you kind of do, you know. After a year of not having a job in the theater, you start thinking dark things. You start to question yourself.
This comes up all over the place. I mean, for everybody, you know, that what would you do if you weren't doing this?
What would I do if I wasn't doing this?
I mean, so when you get the dark moments,
yeah,
you know, what can you do but keep going forward?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I'm asking that. I'm
no,
not
no,
saying
no.
That
it is kind of a rhetorical question. I mean, I didn't minor in anything, and I didn't want to.
Minor in anything.
You know,
I love it. Right. No,
I
right.
know, and I know why I didn't, because I would have done that.
Frank Wildhorn was beginning to think of himself as a musician, and his parents were saying to him, have something to fall back on.
Yeah.
And the father of a friend of his who was a musician said, don't have something to fall back on because you will.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah, and that was my philosophy.
Right. Well, it worked for him, and it seemed to work for you.
It is. It's working for me.
It's because you pretty much have to keep going forward.
Yeah. You know, there's a relationship with the stage. That it's a safe place.
Oh, that's wonderful.
You know what I mean?
I do know what you mean.
And you've got the hours of rehearsal and all of the frustration of making it feel right.
And the
gone.
Support of everybody
and the
else.
The support of your actor. You
right.
know, you're looking another person in the eyes.
Yes.
And even if you're jumping around the room,
yes.
you're still looking at somebody and you're saying, you're okay.
Yeah.
We're okay.
Right. We're all right here. Yeah. We're together.
I've got you. Yeah.
Right. I got you.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so nice.
Yeah. And then you have this weird fourth wall, and there's 600 people looking at you, but that could be, but that's a good thing too, you know, because you have their laughter.
Yes.
And you have their energy, and you can feel their energy looking at, you know, you can feel it coming, and it's like sunshine in a dark, dark room, you know what I mean?
Yes, I know. It's lovely.
But it's also safe, you know. I don't have to talk to them. I don't have to look at them.
No.
But I get to communicate with them somewhere else. And that's kind of happening back and forth.
Yes.
But I don't have to look at it, and I don't have to acknowledge it.
Again, it's all these levels that are going on at the same time, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've never heard anybody talk about it quite this way.
It's very alive. It's very alive. It's life, you know.
Yes.
It's the experience of life on so many different levels. But you know, if I ever had to stop a performance and turn to the audience and look at them, I probably would feel very uncomfortable all of a sudden. Very shy and uncomfortable.
So have you thought ever of doing a one-person thing?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
All right.
I would love to do that. Yeah. And I don't have any problem with looking at the audience if it's in this
If you're room. In character.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just, I don't know why. I guess you create a set of rules that makes you feel at home and safe.
Yeah.
You know?
I think it's what you were saying really at the very beginning from, you know, junior and high school on, that is the place you belong.
Yeah, I think so.
And when you find the place you belong, then you can take all kinds of risks there, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, gosh, it's even scary to say that's a place I belong.
What?
I just feel like, you know, I'm humbled by it, too, you know. I earn it. I earn the right to be there, I guess. And I have to do honor to it, too. You know, I can't go into performance. I can't not feel like it. I have to feel like it physically, you know.
Yes.
Mentally, I have to be ready. You know, I'm a little hungover today, so.
No, I imagine that that's the truth in every performance, but in Boeing Boeing, so much is required of you.
Yeah, I find myself definitely really self-conscious about, like, you know, eating well. And,
right,
you
getting
know,
enough rest, you know, and all that stuff. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, and
yeah. I imagine you're tired when it's done.
I am, yeah.
Yeah, I imagine, right.
I am.
Well, we're grateful for all of the energy that you're putting out, so.
Well, I'm just grateful for the chance to do it and to be here. And I really am. I mean, I love being down here.
Okay, we've really been talking about this the whole time, but I'd like to ask, just thinking about having really dedicated all of your life so far to this, is there anything that you want to say about what it's like to live a life dedicated to an art?
I think it's like it's like a really good marriage, you know?
Yes.
It does take a lot of your lifestyle, you know, and it takes sacrifice, and it takes commitment, and, you know, there's some crappy days where you just want to tell it to go away, you know, but I'm in love, you know.
Yes.
So, I'll be with it until the end, and, when I'm up, sometimes it'll be down, and when I'm down, sometimes it'll lift me up, you know. So.
I'm crying again.
I know. It's a really good marriage.
It's lovely. Thank you so much, Jason. That was my first interview with Jason. And as I said, he's thoughtful and serious and interesting. I didn't say in the run-up that he's charming and delightful and easy to talk to and fun. But he is all of that, and I imagine that you heard it in this interview. So now, Jason has returned, after being gone from us for several years, to help Summer Dawn Wallace and Brendan Reagan open their dream, the Urbanite Theater. This is the newest addition to the Sarasota arts community, and as Summer Dawn and Brendan say, there is a tremendous amount of art and culture in Sarasota, but it is their belief that there's nothing like the Urbanite Theater. No small black box theater where they do cutting edge work and art. So this is their dream, this is their passion,
And their friend, Jason Bradley, has come back to help them, to support them, and to offer his talents in the opening show, which is a show called Chicken Shop. So in my second interview with Jason, I got an opportunity to hear from him what he's been doing since he left us, and that is very exciting. And so after we catch up, Jason talks about the Urbanite Theater, what it is hoping to accomplish for Sarasota. And he talks about the first show, the opening show, Chicken Shop, and what you can expect when you come to see it. But he also talks about what it feels like for an actor to work in a black box theater as opposed to what he's been doing, huge theaters with lots of people and lots of production values. The Urbanite Theater is a small space. You're sitting very close to, even kind of on top of, the actors. So in a way, you are an intricate part of the performance. And Jason talks about how exciting it is to be back in a rehearsal room and also to be doing this cutting-edge, important theater. So here's Jason, once again, talking from his knowledge and experience of acting, what it means to be the kind of actor that he is. Okay, so tell me what you've been doing since I saw you last.
Since I saw you last, let's see. We saw each other my final year at the Oslo, right?
It was
Boeing.
Yep. Right.
So from there, I went to do Midsummer Night's Dream with Peter Amster, Indiana Rep.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. That's where I met Peter originally. And that was fun.
I'll bet.
I got to play one of the rude mechanicals and and one of the fairies. I was Peas Blossom.
Oh.
Yeah. I looked like Strawberry Shortcake. I had a big...
Oh, really?
Big, bright, pink little...
Yes, he's making a belly.
Yeah, I'm making a belly.
Right.
It was fun. And then during rehearsals for that, I auditioned for $1 Million Quartet. I was Sam Phillips, the guy who discovered Elvis and Johnny Cash. I had a blast. Those guys are fantastic. I, on top of $1 Million Quartet, because we all have understudies, and because the company management is so great with them, I was able to be on TV, and I had a recurring role on a show called Crisis on NBC, and was on Chicago Fire, and did some exciting on-camera stuff. So fast forward almost 2 years later, and over 500 performances of that.
So how did this happen?
This happened. Summer Dawn sent me a Facebook message and said, "Too bad, so sad that you're doing the longest-running Broadway musical in Chicago."
Right.
And my contract with them was up at the beginning of April, so I asked pretty please to the producers if I could get up early and come down here and start rehearsals. So I had two shows on a Saturday, got in my car, drove down here, and started rehearsal on Tuesday. I'm having a blast.
Okay, tell me about the show.
Chicken Shop, written by Anna Jordan, and won the Best of the London Fringe. She's a really exciting playwright who writes really, really, I think mostly urban, kind of intense relationship stuff. It takes place in a small room above a fried chicken shop where a prostitute, she's been trafficked by an Eastern European guy, and now she lives in that room and only in that room and eats only the chicken from downstairs and doesn't even realize that JFK Airport is a mile away, you know.
Right.
There's a mother and her girlfriend, and the mother's son, and the son is the link between the two worlds. He's a 19-year-old boy who's at that age where he's confused and frustrated by what's happening in his home and doesn't know what it means to be a man in terms of sexuality and is extremely confused. That's a big theme of the Chicken Shop. It's... I guess what happens to a man in this culture when in terms of sexuality, how to be a man and what's expected of you, and he goes off to this prostitute with an idea of what he's looking for and what he needs, and so everybody's kind of searching in this play, and it's delicate and it's beautiful and it's intense. I don't want to give away too much of it, but you know, his mom works at an organic food shop, and he doesn't have a traditional masculine figure in his life, and he doesn't believe in violence of any kind, and just finds himself angry and you know, spiteful towards his mom and her mom's decision, as we all do at some point in our teenage life, and lashes out and goes searching for stuff, and I think he definitely ends up with more than he could chew. Yeah, it's dark. There's moments of comedy, and the first row is "For Me to You Away."
Oh, that's right. Yeah. He's pointing to how far away we are standing. We are literally from each other.
Yeah, but I have nothing but admiration and respect for, you know, Summer, Donna, and Brendan, and what they're doing. And you know, this isn't the sort of work that I normally do, or the work that I can afford to do. But they put a lot of their heart into it. A lot, you know, 15 months of their heart into it. I think it's a really bold first show to be putting up, and it's kind of setting the tone for what the Urbanite Theater is doing. And it's kind of filling in a niche here that you don't really see with some of the other theaters here. It's a black box. And for somebody like me, from where I just came, to get into a black box, which is where great actors are made, by the way, in New York and in Chicago, and no matter where you go, these little black boxes where you have up to 99 seats is where amazing things happen in the theater, because you're focused on telling the story and really only that. This kind of black box theater where there's an intense theme and there's a lot of sexual material in the show, it's sort of shocking to the system, and I think this theater has a place in this community, and I love this community, so I wanted to come down here and do everything I could to help them out, and it's selfish too, you know. I haven't been in a rehearsal room for a few years, so it's not bad to be able to get back into the swing of things.
Right.
Down here instead of in the middle of Chicago.
Yes, right. So, do you know what you're doing next, or?
No, I have no idea. You know, I'll probably end up going back to Chicago and seeing what happens.
That was great.
Yeah.
I'm sorry you missed that.
The great gesture is what's next as an actor?
Right.
But, you know, I'm really excited for that. I'm really excited. When you don't have that for 2 years and you don't really know, you don't have that. That what's next feeling is the source of a lot of creative energy in an actor, I think.
God, that is such an interesting perspective.
Yeah.
Also, you'll be, is it still cold in Chicago?
Yeah, it was 28 degrees the other day.
Yeah.
When it was 75 here.
Yes, right.
So.
And you'll get back there around the time that it's thawing out.
That it's thawing out.
Yes,
yeah,
that'd be
great
lovely.
Thaw.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully I'll look like I've been...
In this,
you know, in
that's
if I can ever get out of that black box.
Yeah.
I'm hoping that's going to happen soon. Once we open, then I'll get to the beach. We haven't made it yet.
Okay, so the show opens...
April 10th.
April 10th.
That's
the opening. The preview is the 9th? Or the other way around? Do
that's
you remember?
That's a good question. I haven't
well, I will know, because I'll look it up.
Though it April opens, 10th, I believe, is the official opening.
The Friday.
So, yeah, that Friday.
Right?
Yeah.
Right. And it runs till...
May 3rd.
May 3rd.
Yeah.
Okay.
Tuesday through Saturday at 8 and Wednesday at... Or, sorry. Tuesday through Saturday at 8 and Sunday at 2.
One performance
a day.
Yeah. On Sunday, one matinee,
yeah.
But not on Saturday.
Not on evening.
And not on Wednesday.
Yeah.
Okay. So come out and see Jason.
Yeah.
You may not get another opportunity for a while.
Well, you never know. Peter and I have been cooking up some things. We'll see what happens.
Oh, yeah? Oh, lovely.
We'll see what happens.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah.
We'd love to have you, Jason.
Oh, gosh. I love being here.
Thank you.
Thank you for sitting down with me.
At the end of that first interview that I did with Jason, he talks about the fact that he describes his relationship to his work as though it is a marriage. He's fallen in love with his work. And so sometimes it's difficult, okay, sometimes it's spectacular, great, but he is committed. He's in love. I've never heard anyone talk about it in quite that way. I think it's quite beautiful. And also, what I understand Jason to be saying is that he is in love with himself. He's in love with himself because he's being himself. He's doing what himself requires. He's true to himself. One can hardly say better than that. One can hardly feel better than that. And as I said in the beginning of the show, this is what is required in order to be comfortable with oneself wherever one is. And you hear it in Jason. You hear what I believe is essential to this, and that is that he got permission to be himself from the very beginning. Parents, friends, teachers, everybody's message was, be yourself. Not everybody gets this message. And if you don't get this message, then it's very difficult to love the person that you are. If you get the message, don't be yourself, then of course the message you're getting is that there's something wrong with yourself. There's something not right about yourself. And so, of course, how can you be comfortable? Always you are aware that there may be something not right about yourself. Jason talks about people telling him that they wanted to be an actor, but their parents said no, and that woman who said, you know, my daughter wanted to be an actor, but I said, oh, no, no. This idea that you can tell another person who they are, actually, you cannot tell another person who they are.
Of course, parents do it quite often to children because they, well, for all kinds of reasons. They want you to be who they want you to be. It scares them to think that you're somebody different than they would want you to be. They didn't get to be who they were, so they don't believe anybody should, or they can't role model it because they didn't get it. You know, just hundreds of reasons, person-specific reasons why parents undermine the who you really are. Sometimes, you know, out of the absolute best intentions, you know, that's a very hard life you're trying to live. Don't do it. It isn't who you are. Who you are is somebody who has a good job, or you're somebody who gets married, or you're somebody who lives where I think you should live, or any number of things, right?
Of course, when we're children and people tell us who we are or who we shouldn't be or who we're not, we tend to believe it and run with it and be ashamed of the person that we know is still in there. But in fact, they cannot tell us who we are. Who we are is still in there. Who you are is still in there. And so as always, it is my hope when you listen to someone who, like Jason, who is so clearly himself, so clearly at peace with himself, that you are asking yourself, do I have this? Am I comfortable with myself? Or am I always concerned that someone will see something in me that I didn't mean to let out, that I didn't mean to expose, and that I have reason to be embarrassed by or ashamed of or afraid to show? So if any of that is true, I hope that having listened to Jason, having listened to me, having listened to any of the other 350-something people that I have interviewed in this show, you are asking yourself, if this isn't true for me, how did I lose it? What did they tell me when I was a child? What did I read or see or observe or come to believe that told me that something about me, something about the way I walk or talk or look or smell or eat, something about what I'm drawn to, that I wanted to sing or dance, something about my gender identity, something about me wasn't okay. How did I get that message? And what can I do to counter that message, to recover what is real about me and fall in love with it? So if that's something that you're thinking about and you'd like to talk to me about that, you can go to my website, thelynshow.com. T-H-E-L-Y-N-N-E. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. Thelynshow.com. Up there, there's a link to email me. Ask me any question you like. I'll be happy to hear from you. You can get me to come to talk to your group or organization. You can listen. You can re-listen to Jason's interview, and you can listen to any of the other interviews that I have ever done. So, as always, I sure hope that you got something from this show that you can use. Because, as always, I will be back next week, same time, same station, and I sure hope you will be back as well.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. On ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight, no, no. We will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. Singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten limper, but I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang.
someone can tell you what you are. No one can tell you what you are, although people do it all the time.